Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking to today?
Today we're speaking with Reggie James. He's a writer, product architect, and investor. He previously co-founded the company Eternal and recently published a book about contemporary hardware called Hardware 2024.
I thought this was a fun conversation. Full disclosure, we already had it. We are recording this intro afterwards. Reggie has some really refined and interesting thoughts about spirituality and technology and the way that spirituality manifests in how people make technology. That was something I was really looking forward to speaking with him about and did not disappoint.
I agree. I really enjoyed this conversation, and as well as Reggie's post-founder exit glow.
Okay, one interesting thing before we get into the conversation. I started reading this book last night, new novel, The Fact Checker by Austin Kelly, which is about a fact checker in New York City. But one thing that I had not seen before, I'm sure this has been on books that I've read. I don't know when they started printing this, but on, you know, one of the first pages, the copyright page and such, they say, any use of this publication to train generative artificial intelligence, quote unquote, AI technologies, is expressly prohibited. The author and publisher reserve all rights to license uses of this work for generative AI training and development of machine learning language models. I don't know if this is just the boilerplate. The publisher was Grove Atlantic, Atlantic Monthly Press. But yeah, it was the first time I'd seen it. Have you seen that before?
Oh, yeah, I have. But okay. Not in a book that I bought. Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
Not in a book that
I've
you bought.
I've seen photos of it online.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, you recently published a book, Hardware 2024. Have you bought any of this 2024 hardware? What's your favorite piece of hardware from the last year?
I think my favorite piece of hardware, it's probably a toss-up between the USB Club Transport, which is really special. I mean, I DJ and I collect files. And so it's full terabyte solid state drive. So I'm not really concerned about files getting messed up. And then do you know this spot downtown called Vowels? It's like a Japanese store, but they have this archive library where you can like book an appointment. And the founder brought all of these like vintage books and zines from Japan. And you can like scan pages and then just take them with you. So sometimes if I'm digging for a reference, I'll like take my USB down there, scan some stuff, and then bring it back and talk with Luca about it, you know, in our Figma. The other one I actually have right here is the Teenage Engineering TP7.
I was going to ask if you'd bought this.
It's very beautiful.
I was gifted it.
You were gifted? Yeah, okay.
I could not spend like $1,500 on just a voice recorder.
Because it's like you can get like the Zoom recorder one for like $70. And right. This one's $50. Yeah, it's so slick though.
But it's really beautiful. It's a really gorgeous weight.
Looks like a Dieter Rams, right?
I mean, it has that energy. Definitely with them.
I got to explain Dieter to my husband a couple weeks ago.
Whoa.
Yeah, he wasn't up. It's okay. He doesn't have a design background, but my friend had given me this dead stock Braun travel alarm clock.
Okay.
And that she found in her stuff. And it, you know, it's not an expensive piece, but it's actually kind of hard to get now because I just think they don't sell it anymore. And so I was like, do you know what Braun is?
do you use the voice recorder? Like, will you like go on a walk and like record some notes or something? Or
so I had a phase of doing that. That was fun. I actually find it.
I'm going to bike up behind you and just snatch it while you're doing that.
That'd be sick. I used to do that. I kind of got scared of that. And then just bonk on the head from some design guy.
I don't even want your ledger. Keep the ledger, bro.
the security around the personal devices.
Is Ledger in the book?
No.
They're not a 2024 brand.
I think it's like, I think the Stax was 2023. I think it's most fun at like parties, like passing it around and people leaving voice notes and seeing how unhinged they get. Like, I think one of my favorite ones was like Eric Adams did nothing wrong and we should reelect him. That's a good one.
But gee, I heard you give an even hotter take at the Blackbird pop-up, but I don't know if you want to get into it today.
Was it about Jan 6?
It was.
That actually, I stole that from a friend who left it on the voice recorder. I was like, oh, this is my take now, which is basically like, if you really believe that the government, you know, is corrupt, like you deeply believe that to be true, then Jan 6 is a sort of logical response.
It's a rational response to perceived tyranny.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense, honestly.
See?
Well, you know, now that like Kareem has sort of like run through everyone in New York, I think they're going to have all of us on, and whoever goes on first gets to use the January 6th take.
Yeah. I just want to get on that the New York Mag cover whenever they do the part two of that.
Where it's like 100 people and they're all walking. Yeah.
I failed. And as a New Yorker, if I don't care.
Adam Faze took your spot despite not being from New York.
Yeah. This is Los Angeles ass.
Okay. Also on the book, though, it's kind of anchored by an interview with Jasper, the founder of Teenage Engineering, correct?
Yeah.
Not to, you know, spill everything behind the paywall of buying your book, but can you tell us a little bit about that conversation?
Yeah, that conversation was really special. So, you know, he's not necessarily known for being out in public like that in terms of like recorded interviews. I can always tell when I want to do something if I feel really shameless about asking favors. And so I just asked for like 20 favors to get to the team. Mm-hmm. And then his right-hand guy, or one of his right-hand guys, Emil, who I've now, you know, been fortunate enough to become friends with, he sort of did like a pre-screening interview with me. And then he was like, okay, Jesper is either going to be in San Francisco or LA in this month. So just stay like flexible.
Stay mobile.
Yeah, stay mobile, stay on your toes. And he ended up being in San Francisco. He gets off a flight from Tokyo. I meet him at his hotel. He's like dropping laundry off at the front desk. And he's like, yeah, do you like want to get a beer or something? And it's 2 p.m. in San Francisco. And I'm just like, dog, there are no bars that are open in this town right now. And we end up at this like really shitty dive bar in downtown SF. Basically, the only guys in there, they're like blaring rock music. And we just kind of pound beers for like 3 hours. And so the interview gets like progressively looser and more fun. And by the end, he's talking about like Silicon Valley as like a Vatican. And it gets very fun.
Are you recording this interview on the Teenage Engineering?
No. That was my gift after they confirmed I wasn't a weirdo.
That's nice. That's nice.
Yeah, I recorded it on my phone.
San Francisco, you've been tweeting about it. You just got back, obviously. You had this one tweet: San Francisco is the most contemporary city in America. Interpret that as you will. You also tweeted about how it's a lightwash denim city. Also interesting, but I haven't been to San Francisco in a long. I'm from Northern California, but like far further north of that, and I haven't been to San Francisco in maybe a decade.
Whoa!
Give us a scene report.
That's crazy, because I would assume San Francisco is Black Levi's, but I think that these programmers just have too many Cheeto crumbs on their hands to be doing that.
Daisy, that's such like a 2009 take.
No, I would say it's a contemporary take in the same way that San Francisco is a contemporary city.
That's good. That's really good.
Well, let's hear from Reggie. What's the least to give us?
Yeah, what's the Cheeto dust count?
Yeah, what's the Cheeto dust count? I would say there's about a 10% spread on Cheeto dust in the city. So on the contemporary city thing. I think whenever I think about the word contemporary, I think about it as like a slight, like history is very low on that value scale. You know, it's like, I think San Francisco is a city that like every 6 months you go back, it feels very different. Mm. It feels like the meta has changed. Even like also probably because like the startup boom and bust nature, like where offices are keep shifting. Like the people with the most stable offices are just like VCs. You know, everyone else is kind of like moving about. They're either scaling up or scaling down, or they just got bought. So I think that permeates throughout not only the architecture, but the people that feel important at any given time. That feels like it's just really, it's always sliding, which makes it feel very contemporary to me. Whereas I think New York, there's like some stable characters. The architecture itself is quite stable, even if like, oh, new cafe or whatever. It's like, odds are it looks and feels like something that already is around there. Mm-hmm. In terms of like the light wash denim, it was just like, I was having a glass of wine, just looking out at the street. And I just felt like I saw like 20 people in the same exact light wash denim. And I was so confused. And so I tweeted it because I don't think.
What about the shoes? What were they wearing shoe wise?
They're always just kind of wearing like On Running or, you know, they're just wearing like running sneakers. It doesn't matter who it is or what they're actually doing. I will say my hot take on SF is that all their romantic issues are just a skill issue. There are plenty of like beautiful, smart, dope women walking around that city. They're all just like touch deprived, and the men there they're not doing anything about it. You know, they're just like, I don't know, whoop maxing or something, sleep score maxing. It's rough.
Too many wearables.
Too many wearables giving them too many inputs on what they're doing right and wrong, you know?
I've never been to San Francisco. And now it feels like a bit to just keep not going. Yeah.
See, my bit is currently like almost every time I land, I'm like landing in the best city in the world. That's my bit. Which, you know, for some people, it is the best city in the
world. Have you ever lived there for like a longer than like a month?
No, I've gotten pretty close to a month. Like I've been like 3 weeks, I think. But no. And I don't think I have to, nor do I intend to. Someone would have to like pay me some ridiculous amount of money.
What they do there. I hear.
If Zuck is like, hey asshole, here's $100 million, you're coming to the Bay Area, I'd be like, yes, daddy. Yeah, yes, daddy Zuck.
So it was not Zuck who acquired Eternal, is what
I know who it was. I'm not telling.
Not on mic.
So you were just at FWB Fest.
Yes.
Scene report. How did you get there? Since we're talking about transportation, this is just a transportation podcast.
Yeah.
Best talk, best performance.
These are all so easy.
Okay.
Pop down from SF. So that flight. Okay. You've never been to SF, so you don't know it. But the San Francisco to LA flight is like you go up and then you just start coming back down. It's just so quick. We got a like convertible Jeep. So me, Sean, Yatu, and Norm just sort of ripped this convertible Jeep across California to get to from LA to Idlewild, which was really lovely. Just good.
Yeah, it's quite the drive.
Quite the drive, but it's very dudes rock, you know, on that drive. It's very dudes rock.
Well, last year, like, our driver was, like, watching YouTube videos while he was taking the...
terrifying.
The turns, the, like, hairpin
turns. Your
driver?
Turns. You took an Uber from LA to this 3-hour...
No, it was a black car.
Oh, okay.
While I was speaking, so they sent a car for, like, everyone arriving together. But, so that was, like, less dudes rock. The Jeep convertible sounds a lot cooler.
Yeah, very dudes rock. And then, do you know the cathedral folks in LA? They're doing like music patronage. They took over the library. And so that's where I was speaking in. And then I did the Dialectic Live podcast with Jackson in the main auditorium. I would say Fest this year felt a lot more music centric than like idea centric. Typically, I would say it's nearly 50-50 and like the nerds take over the auditorium and then what have you, but this felt like almost 80-20, like music people over like the nerds, which was interesting. My favorite talk, I would say, was Nick Soucy. Friend of the pod, I'm sure. Really, really incredible. It was like cinematic. Him and his wife created these visuals and she did all this audio. Just like music sound scoring, and it was just like full cinematic experience. I felt it in my heart.
I have one of the papers he made.
Yes,
for
let's
it.
Go.
Yeah,
yeah.
Did you get a nice birthday party, Francis?
Yeah, yeah. Where were you?
Well, I had a mouse situation in my home. It's crazy.
What else is new?
The mouse. You know, like that clip where Michael Jordan's like, and I took that personally. A few weeks ago, exterminator comes. I say, I haven't seen the mouse in a year. Next day, mouse.
Mouse.
He took it personally. So Ben was gone the day of Nick's party, and I was like home. Like I was doing like Lowe's.
You're at Home Depot.
Yeah. Yeah. But then I got like
you were tweeting about this.
I got three texts being like, are you going to Nick's party? I was like, the Dirtyverse Demimond is real. Because you got pulled into it through me.
Mm-hmm.
But Josh Zorner, also now in the extended Nick Susie
I didn't see
universe.
Him.
Well, he also wasn't able to go. And then Natasha also texted me. But anyway, I think it's funny. I don't know if you saw this, Reggie. Like somebody on LinkedIn did like mapped out Emily Sundberg's influence. Mm-hmm.
And then you did it to Ty Haney also this week.
Oh, really?
Funny.
Two podcasts.
Right. Well, it visualized it and Dirt was its own cluster.
Ooh.
I know.
I like that. You have to own your own cinematic universe or else you're part of someone else's.
I think it's everyone who contributed to the notes book at this point. Like, that's a pretty good proxy for...
Well, because I think it was measured through, like, tags and mentions on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
So that's a heavy volume of tags and mentions.
Yeah, see, this becomes, like, this shows, like, the importance of actually producing artifacts. You know, like, when you can produce an artifact... This is kind of how I feel about, like, the hardware book. Like, when you can, like, stake something in the ground, you can actually lay claim to some sort of land space.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just, like, 1 acre of land, at least it's your land. And I think New York sometimes can represent sort of like apartment culture to me is sort of like at culture. You know, you're just like adding each other's apartments all day, but mm-hmm. no one really owns the land. And it's just like, you gotta figure out land ownership in some dimension.
Yeah. Other than the boomer wealth transfer, millennials can only own land through producing coffee table books.
This is
apartment culture versus hardcover book culture.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, but my hot take on this is I think the only reason I'm sort of like a cusper, so like zillennials, millennials, what okay. have you, mm-hmm. are not owning land or like
are you 27?
I just turned 30.
Okay.
I'm a 95 baby.
Okay, yeah.
I did want to find a way to transition into talking about Secutech.
Oh, sure.
Versus spiritual technology. This is something I've read your writing on this, and I don't fully grasp it. I would love mm-hmm. for you to explain a little bit. What's the difference between a secular technology framework versus spiritual technology, and why you think that religion is like maybe a more effective axis for this than, say, like capitalism versus socialism or something like that?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think I'll try to give like the most linear version of this. I was sort of looking at like the past 20 years of like what I would say is like the popular notion of technology construction, right? Which is like when you say technology to someone, what do they think about? Like they're not thinking about like vaccines or anything. They're thinking about like software or SaaS, whatever.
Yeah.
And to me, it all felt deeply postmodernist, right? Like just deeply ingrained in the values of postmodernism. Some of those values include like crisis of representation. And I was like, okay, what software represents crisis of representation? And I was like, okay, social media is such a clean pairing with that. And I started just trying to connect these lines of like, what are postmodernist values and what are products that represent that? And it all felt incredibly like the past 20 years of software production, some hardware production. But so then I was looking at that and I'm part of this like working friend think group of like Dauda Leonard, Elon Rutberg, Freddie and Zuris, and we just call it spiritual technology. And the idea was just like, okay, well, if we look at current tech as like this sort of postmodernist lens, one layer above that is just that it's broadly secular philosophies that guide all of these thoughts, right? Like no one is really out there putting a vision together of like Reform theological technology or like Kabbalah technology, you know, like no one is like doing that. And so we just made this really, because everyone has different spiritual practices, we just made this really clean line of like secular technology versus spiritual technology. And so secular technology is just like broad philosophical frameworks, and then spiritual technology would be rooted in some historic spiritual practice that outdates all these philosophies, right? Because philosophy kind of moves like through trend lines, like art movements. Mm. So That was that initial split. So now I'm Presbyterian. So I've been spending a lot of my time on just like a reformed theological view of what to both critique and look at current sets of technology, but also like what could be interesting new technologies. I actually think the people that do this the most right now are Catholics. Like the Vatican released a super long letter on AI. That's genuinely really interesting. You know, they have like the Halo app, which I think is like the most popular, like Catholic.
What is Halo?
It's like mini, it's like video feeds of mini sermonettes. Sorry, my Pocono's accent came out. Mini sermonettes. There's sort of like daily prayer, daily Bible verses. I think there's a Bible within it. Maybe you could put like prayer requests through it. It's just like a lot of Catholic traditions.
Religious practice in an app.
There should be Tinder for like Bible verses where you're like, I'm vibing with this one.
I'm 100% sure there is.
Oh, I could vibe code that today. That would be fun. Actually, the worst thing about like
Bibbler. Yeah. I'm sure that's taken.
That's definitely taken. Also way too close to Diddler. I think the worst part of like using a Bible app is when the thing comes up and it's just like, are you enjoying the Bible app? And you're like, yes. And then it's just like, can you rate us in the app store? And it's like, oh man.
I can't do that.
That's not close to godliness at all.
It's not close to godliness. Yeah. Listen, retention metrics are not close to godliness.
Oh my god.
So anyway, just on to continue on the secular tech versus spiritual tech. So that's sort of how that basis came about. Elon has this like really ginormous deck that looks at sort of like historical spiritual technologies, which he includes like the rosary or I think in Jewish culture it's called tefillin.
Frances? Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, I sit here when I'm podcast. I call this the podcaster's rosary. The
yes.
Anyway.
Yes. Really nice. No, that's real. You're just sort of going down your idea chain.
Sorry to interrupt, but yeah.
I use mine as an abacus.
That's a good
one. I'm like, how much runway do I have left?
Anyways, but yeah, the rosary to film as technology.
So we've been sort of like collecting a bunch of these thoughts and ideas in this like informal working group. I gave a talk at Hereticon last fall on this idea.
Okay, I don't want to interrupt the thought, but I'm like, why isn't Hereticon the Aspen for young people that build things?
And
like, do they think that they are?
Okay, well, for those that might not know, Hereticon is the Mike Solana founded Founders Fund Throne, like kind of like secret conference that happens in Miami. Yeah, it's just like a slate of speakers, like Palmer Luckey will speak, Peter will speak. Who are some other folks? Emmett Shear spoke this past year. His speech was great. And then it's like attended by like David Holtz and Grimes and what's the monarchist dude's name?
Monarchist.
That's not Yarvin.
Yeah, I know Yarvin. Oh, yeah, Curtis Yarvin. Curtis Yarvin. So it's like a very funky cast of characters, but then it'll also just be like Founders Fund founders, like Eric from Ramp will be there, you know, or who's the Rostra founder? What's her name? Lulu. She's like
Lulu. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's not like all edgelords or anything like that, but it's, you know, there will definitely be like Curtis Yarvin next to like
edgelord adjacent.
Me. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Edgelords and edge cases.
Edgelords and edge cases. Yeah. But it's actually quite fun. I think what's funny is, you know, the first Hereticon was like right when Florida was like, okay, enough of this COVID nonsense. And a lot of states weren't like that. And so it felt like this very edgy thing to do.
I mean, worth noting that like most people crawled back to New York with their tail between their legs after that COVID exodus.
Super. And, you know, it's like Taylor Lorenz being like, this is so, you know, unsafe. I can't believe this. And, you know, it was just like, it was really fun. I really loved
it. At the end of the day, it's not about where you pay taxes, it's about where you can go to Metrograph.
Yes.
At 3 p.m. on a Thursday.
Nobody's leaving the city when Zoran wins.
Zoran's New York. Yeah. In many ways, we're already living in it. We're already living in it.
Yeah. How, like, I feel like we've been.
I'm saving my Zoran Tasteland invite. I don't know, Reggie, if you know, I like went to school with him, and my mom was like, my mom was like, I have a great idea. You should interview him. And I was like, Mom.
Wow. Great idea, love.
I'm not pulling that card now. Like, I'm gunning for Crypto Czar in the Zoran administration. Like, and you all are going to really regret some of the things that you said to me when I am Crypto Czar in the Zoran administration. Because
that's going to be sick.
Like, if you want a socialist person who's crypto literate, it's me, David Phelps, or Austin Roby, and only one of us went to the same college, so I'm pulling rank.
That's good.
Oh, man. Anyways, where were we? We're still on
interrupted a really important conversation, actually.
No. I think they were exactly in line. But yeah, the first Hereticon was like, I genuinely do think it was super interesting and edgy, and like this thing of just like, okay, like if we're talking about exercising our freedoms to this degree, like fucking show up and do it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people did do it, and that pissed some people off. I was really happy to be involved. I was very inspired by it, you know, speaking freely. The second one, but I think one funny thing there was like Biden had won already. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Biden had just won, basically.
Was it pre or post January 6th?
Post. Yeah, okay. Post January 6th. And so there was a really funny tension in the air of just like, of this exercising of freedom, which I really, really liked. This one was right before the election, this most recent election. Mm. And it kind of felt like a pre-celebratory victory lap. Like everyone knew what was going to happen. But I think because of that, it just didn't feel edgy. Like I didn't feel like the heretical thing to do there would be to be like a very clear white guys for Kamala t-shirt wearing person, you know, mm-hmm. And that was not the vibe. So it felt very victory lappy. The ideas were still interesting for the most part. Like I can't, yeah, I don't want to say too many of them, but like, the ideas were so interesting, but it just felt like a victory lap, which I think changed the vibe like a little bit.
I also think my hot take is that the tech right and the religious right cannot coexist. And the 100%. Tech right trying to get in bed with the religious right will actually be the end of the tech right. And like, I don't think the tech right will have real political power for a very long time, but their entrenched social power will all shift to AI and AI integration into everything.
Mm. I think you're right about the tech right and the religious right not being very compatible. I do think that the tech right isn't going anywhere, like sort of influence wise. I think some people will sort of like fade out. I also think there's a good chunk of like tech right people that are really just doing this to accumulate sort of like further personal power, and they'll switch up when needed. I think this is sort of like, there's sort of legitimacy laundering in order to like set up their next play. Mm-hmm. I think there's something there. I also think the only thing a lot of these tech right people even believe in is technology itself. They don't really have political ideals, you know? They view themselves as somewhat post-political, and that's why they were so willing to shift to the right for this upcoming era. And I also think Trump kind of sees through that. Like, I think Trump is very just like if Elon couldn't like flex his desires on Trump, like, you know, this some random ass Doge kid is not going to. So mm-hmm. there's something funny there to break down.
Yeah. I also think like some people are just maybe a little unwell.
Deeply true.
Well, definitely spiritually unwell.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I think Silicon Valley has really lost touch with any relationship to spiritual wellness that it had. Like, because there was the sort of like ayahuasca mm-hmm. era where like spiritual wellness meant like experimenting with drugs and higher thinking and tapping into creativity, and like that led to some cool stuff. It led to some really like not cool stuff.
But that's the thing. Like their even their version of any of spirituality is simply an ingredient for further personal efficiency.
Because they want immortality.
Yeah. You know, and it's just like, yeah, their goals are actually not spiritual. It's like efficiency to code for like 10 hours straight or to prompt, you know, cursor for 10 hours straight. Mm-hmm. And that's not spirituality at the end of the day. It's just like a broader, you know, Brian Johnson style, like health goal. Mm-hmm. And I think a core sense of spirituality, and I'm not even saying this from like a Christian framework, is just like, it's a relinquishing of authority, but that's not what's happening here. Like the last thing these people ever will do is relinquish authority, both on a systemic level or on a, you know, a personal, like how they live their life level.
But I think like from my perspective, as somebody who does consider themselves spiritual, if you sacrifice all of your values to make the tools that can create what essentially will become contemporary cults, you are in the cult of the self. You are in the cult mm-hmm. of money at all costs. And so you might see yourself as the cult leader because you're at the center of the machine, you know, creating technology that's going to have such influence on people that will probably see like new QAnon style religions, like let 1,000 QAnons bloom, right? Excited but you actually are the most captured because, right. you know, you've betrayed and destroyed yourself for nothing.
I think this is what's interesting about the whole like Jeff Lewis thing. Like in that one post, he talks about like being one of the earliest OpenAI investors, and he's also clearly been one-shotted by ChatGPT psychosis. You know,
it's just, this yeah, is that guy. So where he,
yeah. You know,
yeah, think, that guy's like literally unwell, not spiritually unwell.
Yeah, no, he has fully.
But the number of people like taking him seriously because they're like, they're just been trained to like try to find a rationale in anything somebody that they see as having like proximity to capital is saying. It's like, mm-hmm. if a poor person is going through psychosis online, like your response would be so different from like when a wealthy person, it's like people are doing like liner notes. Like people were legitimately like trying to interpret what he was saying. And it's like, he's not saying anything. Like he's in psychosis.
Yeah. I mean, I do for off the air. I do think I understand what else is happening, but I do agree with you. There's sort of this, like, because of his capital position, folks are willing to engage in like some like weird deconstruction period, which is just like, no, check him in. Check him in.
I mean, this is kind of like that Vanity Fair article that you were quoted in from March about Christianity in Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah.
Where the subtitle of it, I wrote it down. The subtitle is like, there are people that are leveraging Christianity to get closer to Peter Thiel, which is just what you're talking about, Daisy, just like doing anything to get closer to and acquire capital.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, a really interesting one is also like, now I'm blanking on the story, but yeah, I think like 100%.
Well, a thing I was thinking about as I was preparing for this and thinking about tech and religion, is my favorite line from Conclave, where Ray Fiennes' character is doing a speech and he says, "Our faith is a living thing precisely because it walks hand in hand with doubt. Mm-hmm. If there was only certainty and no doubt, there would be no mystery and therefore no need for faith. Let us pray that God will grant us a pope who doubts, and let him grant us a pope who sins and asks for forgiveness and who carries on." So I thought of that in the context of like, I think that is so descriptive of founder culture in the tech world and in Silicon Valley and in entrepreneurship, in this era of entrepreneurship where it is so like individual faith-based. Every, you know, statistically, nearly every startup fails. And so you mm-hmm. have to have this kind of unfounded faith. Though that within that too, it's like, what is the level of doubt? I don't know. Or like as a founder, you have to inspire this faith in your employees at an early stage startup, at any stage startup, like, because it's always doomed to fail except for what you do to bring it forward.
Yeah. It's so fun. One, that was my favorite part in Conclave as well. I was talking about this with a friend who recently left the company, and you know, it was like mix of I think I need to leave and then getting fired, and it was just like mutual understanding it wasn't working, right?
Yeah.
And I was talking to them and I was saying, you know, the number one thing I genuinely love about technology is also its most Christian thing, which is that like failing upward is actually sort of like structurally built in. Like in Christianity, you sin every single day, and yet God picks you up and still promotes you into like his love and his holiness. And in tech, it's like the faith element of this whole system is like believing that yeah. like, even if I go, if I leave the most secure thing I have and I go out and try to take a big swing, if I fail, I still will actually be rewarded for showing like this general like sense of contribution to the overarching mm-hmm. project. And I think that's like one of the most important things that technology has going for itself, and would be a real shame if we lost it. I also think this is what's why people are so feeling such a type of way about like the whole like kind of windsurf and all these new acquisition formats happening, because it feels like a break in that social structure. I have a lot of opinions there, but I think the most important thing is like the faith is in like technology industry's set of unique social protocols, and knowing that like obviously you shouldn't just go out and intentionally fail upward. That's lame and people do that. But I do think like if you put in the true work and you make that decently public and you share that with people, you will get rewarded for the attempt if you are talented, right? Obviously, if you're not talented, that's a separate issue. But
I do think though, it's who can afford to be a tech disciple in an economy that is not working for the common man. Like you could say, you could have a like prosperity gospel mentality of like, well, that just, it just filters for the people with the most faith because they're living up the most security. But I personally, and like, obviously you might disagree, have never understood this perspective that like Scandinavia, the welfare state of Scandinavia is anti-innovation because people are not driven enough. I do really feel like I have this like American Protestant work ethic, but I also think there's a point of precarity at which like people become nihilistic and demotivated. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people, the line is healthcare security, and security around having children. And so I just wonder, like, has America gone so far in the direction of pro-innovation that we've basically become that like that airplane with the bullet holes diorama where it's like America is so great because like we've never given people total security in these parts of life, where it's like actually like you could find like 100 of the next greatest founders if they knew that they were not one hospital bill away from being bankrupt. I don't know, I feel very strongly about that. But I definitely am in the minority in that as well.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I deeply agree with the need for universal healthcare. I think I don't know if I've ever applied it to that's the thing holding back great founders. I'd want to sit with that more. But I do see the argument. I think that at the core of sort of this belief to me is something I was actually talking about with Jackson Dahl, which is like, I do think one mistake is that we view sort of, we kind of tie instant gratification culture along with our professional culture, particularly in technology. And I think I'm pretty sensitive to like the multi-generational view. Like, you know, both of my parents grew up extremely poor in New York. My mom's the youngest of 7, my dad's the oldest of 8. And my dad learned to trade, right? Plumbing, which then moved us to the Poconos. And the goal, they're very clear and expressed goal. And I'm grateful that my dad enjoyed plumbing, but like they wanted to set up their kids to take whatever swing they wanted to, right? And I think in very different ways, but, you know, in a really core sense, like all three of their kids have done that slash are doing that. And, you know, I think I have like a very similar view, which is just like, I just want my kids to be able to like take a swing. And that comes with a sense of security. Yeah. I guess it becomes like this question of authority of like, does this, how much security does the state have to provide? I think America is struggling with a general state, like a lack of state capacity, even for like basic things like this, which is very frustrating, I think, to all of us. Particularly when we compare it to like our quote rival now, China. Yeah, I'm like trying to work through this in real time. I do think though that it's actually maybe more of a legibility issue. I think there's a lot of people that complain that like Silicon Valley isn't like legible enough, but I just don't think that's true. Like all of YouTube is right there for your consumption. Open the YC like YouTube page and freaking go through all the years of startup school that they have recorded since like, I don't know, 2013 or maybe earlier than that, maybe like 2011. Like these things are actually not mysteries. And I think you really can just sort of like walk in and do things, but I don't know.
I think, well, one thing I'd say here is like the, let's say the private capital, venture capital form of like providing these opportunities versus maybe like a Works Progress Administration, a private versus public way of like providing these opportunities. I think that's kind of a compelling axis for the argument, to the argument for me, is like the private capital one is like any innovation or, you know, whatever, the founder culture, et cetera, like ends up going back into the majority of that value often ends up going back into private capital. Whereas something when capital was more publicly owned, right, then like you're building roads. You're building,
but that's not completely true, right? Because like a lot of these are like, a lot of LPs are pension funds. A lot of like, I think Mount Sinai Hospitals is like a major LP into a lot of these major firms. And so these are actually going to like really core research institutions, hospital systems, teachers' pensions. So like when these things fail, obviously it is a small financial mix of their overall financial system, but there is a direct relationship there. I will say the thing that I do agree with you on is the other side of this, which is essentially something I would argue for is like a sense of creative direction for the country, right? Like what are the express missions? So in China, for a good period of time, there was the centralized party gave a certain allowance to like the regional administration of these parties, and they just like wrote checks based off of priorities of the centralized party. And so if like that was roads, like if you had a roads company, even if it was bullshit, you can like apply for like this funding, and like you went off and did that project. And while a lot of it failed, there were like some really big successes that kind of paid for a good chunk of it. But at minimum, there was actually just kind of like a lot of like groundwork set up. And this is kind of also how you get like housing developments with like no one in it and like all these things. Like there's a lot of funny flaws to that system. But what it did do was create a really direct line on a regional level of like, this is the priority of the government. Who can fill that priority with like their business? And even if you're spinning up that business in real time to achieve that, I would love to see more of that. I mean, it doesn't help when we have like the freaking budget deficit that we have, but I would love to see more of that public, that public energy. One hacky way into this though, that I have a friend doing is, you know, there's all sorts of like design projects that the government needs. So maybe that's like uniforms for the New York Sanitation Department, right? Like maybe that has to get updated. My friend, who's a fashion designer, applies for these funding because it all comes with budget. So he'll apply with like designs. Sometimes he wins them and it'll be like $500,000 and he gets to design this uniform, which obviously goes both into his portfolio, helps him build relationships with manufacturers, all on government spending, and is doing a service for like the city or like whatever. Yeah. So it's really, there's so many of these things out here. I just think, again, it becomes this sort of like mimetic desire question of like, if your only mimetic desire is private SF venture capital, you will see the world through such a narrow lens. But if you're, I said this the other day, I was like, there's people that want to make clients happy and there's people that want to make the work itself happy. You know, yeah. So if you focus, if your client is VC, then you're always going to like sort of stream up to that. If you're, yeah. if your client is the work itself and that's what you center yourself around, you can actually look out and be like, oh, let me try to do this project for like the New York City, you know, sanitation department. And like, I think that's structurally more interesting.
I agree.
Like I would love to design a trash can for New York. I think that would be really, really fun.
So I want to reference one more of the last of your tweets that I saved to reference. This is from like 3 weeks ago. You said it's very relevant to what you're saying now. You said, have been thinking about how to break out of venture timelines in order to have the tolerance for longer and more stable quests, particularly for speculative design research and play. Very inspired by what endowments seem to allow for universities and other institutions. And you were kind of asking for leads or writing. Mm-hmm. Did you receive leads in writing that furthered your thinking?
Yeah, definitely. I actually met up with a few people. I think, you know, one of the best ways to break out of these timelines is just like, who's like a rich person that wants to see certain ideas manifested in the world and they are not worried about a return. I think that's, it's a really lame answer, but it is a real one. I also think we see this in like media, right? Like, I don't know the full financial history of like the free press, but like that clearly was inspired by just a desire for a type of media organization. Mm-hmm. I think there's a handful of these that some are more interesting than others, but it's really just like an idea production center, right? So I think in a really similar way, I also started looking at how the MIT Media Lab came together, which was basically a consortium of like 8 Japanese electronics companies that were curious about what was coming next in technology. And it was like, let's fund this MIT Media Lab. The only non-Japanese corporation that helped fund it actually was Apple. Mm-hmm. And that became the financial basis of the Media Lab. And then I think MIT ran the endowment because they already kind of had their giant endowment. And so they were able to make the carve out. And that's what funded the MIT Media Lab and all the research that happened there, at least initially. And then the history gets complicated because Epstein starts funneling a lot of money into the MIT right. Media Lab.
it's funny. My mom's been really supportive of me having my own company. And I actually think she really gets it on a deep mm-hmm. level. Like I think on a different timeline, my mom really could have been an entrepreneur. And like I was talking to her and I was like, I don't want you to be worried about me because my life has been so unstable the past couple of years because I have this startup. And she said, oh, I don't worry about you because I know that having a startup is a lifestyle choice. And I was like, that was true. Like, I don't even find that offensive because it's like, that is absolutely true.
Yeah.
If people who have startups also have the ability to do something else and thus to live in that uncertainty and doubt and faith is a lifestyle choice. Mm-hmm. I think what I have been pondering to my point earlier is like, who can afford to make that lifestyle choice? Mm-hmm. And are the people who can afford it the smartest, best, brightest people?
Right.
And I really truly believe that like merit does rise to the top in a lot of cases. But I also think like when it comes to people's health or their ability to start a family, it's a net good for society for people not to have to choose between the two.
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is something like my wife and I have been talking about a bunch because I know what my next company is, but I also know like we want to have kids soon. Mm-hmm. And so she was really just like, Reggie, please, like maybe just take a job for a few years. Yeah.
Yeah.
2-3 years break and like also like, you know, recharge and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I deeply agree with you. I think,
do you think you could go back to working for somebody else?
Yes. Because I think part of like the past 6 months now has also been sort of really understanding what being a founder was for me and what it became and also what made me unhappy in it and what made me really happy in it. And I think really taking the time to deconstruct that and sort of like ego strip myself was really important, which not only got me excited about building a company again, but actually made me also excited about finding other people that I could 100% work for and enjoy and blah, blah, blah.
Can you wait? Can you say more on that? Like, what did it mean to you to be a founder? What was? Can you unpack some of what you unpacked?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a giant Obsidian doc on this. I think when you talk to any founder, the time that they're most nostalgic for is when it's like either just them or them and their co-founder, right? And it's really just about the work. They have at least what was true for some to varying degrees, right? But I had no money. I also didn't really have responsibilities. My co-founder had no money. You know, we were really living off of like $4 like egg and cheese sandwiches.
And possibility.
And possibility. We were just eating possibility, the Soylent of startups. And you know, everything was about the work, everything was about the idea. And that's what got us to, you know, like our first round or whatever. And I remember really distinctly, and I think the system also kind of works against you in this way, that like when you're heating up, the system wants to try to superheat you. And I think resisting that is something that every young person needs to like internalize. Like, do not let the system heat you up like too much. Because I think what happened was we had like two products go pretty viral and we felt really good. And then the system was heating us up because of the virality, but then like the retention and reality was cooling us down. And then we didn't really know which to like pattern match to. And the thing about venture also is that it's actually easier to fund people who already have like all of the wheels greased. So it's like teams in place, they have money in the bank, they have a product out. It's easier to give them more money and hope that they figure it out than to cold start somewhere else. So the machine will actually, for a little bit, definitely during ZERP, like help to just kind of keep pushing that forward if your comps are correct, right? And so if you're building like consumer software, the comps are just like sort of like infinite money glitch, right? Because the consumer software things that work really work. So then the thing that happens there is sort of like this weird sort of status laundering where like you have like the really nice Series A, but the thing isn't working, but you have to kind of keep up this weird appearance of just like, it's everything is always so close to clicking. Right. And that's a really weird cognitive dissonance to live in. And
well, that's where the founder faith thing comes in, right?
Yes. But it's like actively conflicting with like your current and inflating status.
It's hard to have faith if you're like overfed.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's like something that I experience. And then what becomes doubly weird and was definitely the eternal story was like the brand and the media through like our show Exit Sign and some other things were like really working. Like we went from zero to 200,000 followers in a year. And so you had something that was really working, but then the thing that was giving you like the tech like valuation multiple was there, but wasn't working at the same way. And so then you're like, oh, do we become a media company that has a shot, or do we try to retain being a tech company that is really like chewing glass? And that also kind of doubled like this feeling of sort of like status laundering. And so, yeah, that was sort of like the spiritual reality. I mean, I could get into like taking on bad advice and stuff, because I think there's a lot there as well. But yeah, I think that I also think when Bryce Roberts talks about this a lot. Like when part of the game is raising money, like, you know that there's things that gets you more money. Like building out a fully fleshed team helps to get you more money, but it also is burning that same money. And I think this is what we saw.
It might not be the exact correct step you're supposed to take, but you just take it because that's how you get more money.
Yeah. And it helps with like all these other sort of like pieces of the progress stack. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think this is also what we're seeing with like this Windsurf acquisition, where like the reality is they needed to scale up. However, like they probably couldn't hire the best people, but they had to like fill these like middle jobs. And now in this acquisition, which what's funny about acquisitions, right, is like most acquisitions involve the team, half of the team getting shed, but like no one talks about acquisitions publicly. And because this acquisition is so public, people really got emotional about the team getting shed in a specific way. And then when the, I think Cognition came and like took the rest of the team in, people really applauded it. But now Cognition is giving all of these people like the opportunity to receive really generous severance packages, but severance packages nonetheless. And it's because the fact is, like, they overhired, and that's like a very classic startup story. And the fact that people don't want to, The other part about faith, just to bring it back to that, is like part of having faith is also knowing that when I admit I did something wrong, there will be forgiveness. Mm-hmm. But because capitalism is unforgiving, like, people really don't want to admit that. And now people are having this weird cognitive dissonance episode in mm-hmm. public, because the fact is they overhired. The acquiring company has to also reckon with that. And their reckoning is with the bottom line, which is unforgiving. But it doesn't square away with the original story that they were doing the right thing by taking on this team. And I don't want to say it's hilarious, because these are people's like financial safety and like healthcare. Like, there are real people. But I do think what is funny is sort of like this cognitive dissonance that tech people should know, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they're doing I mean, maybe it's literally just for Twitter clout, but it's a funny tension.
Cool. Well, this has been Tasteland. This was a good one. Thank you
so much, Reggie. This was awesome.
I apologize for the beeping in the background.
Do not. Oh, please. Do New not. York. Don't dare apologize. All right.
Don't apologize for the city.